Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Our friend Warren Rogan from the Sports Forgotten Heroes podcast joins us to talk about another bonus edition of the jersey number 56, and we have one big name at the top. Let's see if you can guess it before we start speaking about it, and just wait just a moment, you'll hear our top 10. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we are podcasting from America's North Shore, bringing you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So in taking the snap from the sportshistorynetwork.com and handing off to pigskindispatch.com, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey, Derek, thanks for having me. You know, whenever you talk about these numbers that have great giants, for some reason, I'm on the invite list.
I realize that. I see you had your jersey number 10, number 11, recently number 53. I think we've got you down for a few more after number 56 here also.
Yeah. Well, you know, 56 is one of the greatest numbers in the history of the Giants. So I am thrilled to be able to talk with you about that number.
I can't even imagine who you want to talk about 56 for the Giants.
Yeah. You know, just some guy with these, all you have to say is LT, and it's not the LT from the West Coast.
I hear you. Well, we'll start off here with our Hall of Famers. The Pro Football Hall of Fame tells us there are seven players that were number 56 during their career, and they made it into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton. And they are, you know, LT, Lawrence Taylor, number one up there, Chris Dolman, Andre Tippett, Ted Hendricks, Bill Hewitt, Dante Lavelli, and Joe Schmidt, and some great players on that list.
Yeah, I have all seven of them. How can you not in my top 10? And I'll tell you, this is my top 10, counting down from backwards.
Okay.
Keith Brooking at number 10. I have Derek Johnson at number 9. I have Pat Swilling at number 8. I have Dante Lavelli at number 7. I have Joe Schmidt at number 6, Bill Hewitt 5, Andre Tippett 4, Chris Dolman 3, the Stork, Ted Hendricks 2, and LT, obviously, number 1. And like we've done before, Darren, you know, some of these guys, I'm only ranking them based on what I read. I was unable to, you know, I didn't get to see some of these guys play. So it's purely a judgment call with guys like Schmidt and Lavelli and Hewitt. But, you know, I remember when Hendricks played for the Raiders, and I remember watching Chris Dolman play. You know, these guys were, I remember watching them play. And so I have them ranked high. And I think Ted Hendricks is a legit number 2 without a doubt.
Yeah. Well, I looked at it just a little bit different. I had 3 different names than you. I left 2 of our Hall of Famers off. And one of them was Hendricks, because he only wore that jersey for one season. And that was with the Green Bay Packers. Yeah. And he did have 5 interceptions at linebacking position, sort of in the middle of his career.
Yeah.
And I left Hewitt off as well from a Hall of Famers. And I believe the other one I had that was different was Derek Johnson. I didn't have him on my list, but I went from going backwards. I had Al Wilson, John Morris, Keith Brooking, Hardy Nickerson, Dante Lavelli, Pat Swilling, Joe Schmidt, Andre Tippett, Chris Dolman, and then Lawrence Taylor at number 1.
You know, it's funny you said Nickerson. I was looking at his numbers. He could 100% be on that list. He was a terrific player, actually played at Northeastern University, And my brother played at Northeastern University. My brother was a kicker and had a good story around him. He played soccer, went into the football coach's office and said, "Hey, I'm going to be your kicker next year." And the coach told him to get lost. And every day my brother would go there. And finally, just to shut my brother up, the coach said, "All right, come on out to the field. Let's see you kick." And my brother was just walloping the ball. And the coach said, "You be here for practice." My brother only got to play one season. Northeastern, I don't even think, has a team anymore. But during that one season, my brother set all the school records for kicking.
Wow. That is an impressive story.
Yeah. So you could sway me very easily on Hardy Nickerson just from the nostalgic point of view.
And I'm not even talking about Harvey Nickerson when he was a Steeler. I mean, because all of his Pro Bowls were as a Tampa Bay Buccaneer. He was definitely a better Buccaneer than he was a Steeler. Absolutely. And he was pretty good on the Steelers, too. But he had a bunch of those Pro Bowls that he had played in.
Sure. So how do you want to do this? You want to start at number 10 and go backwards? You want to start at number 1 and go forwards? How do you want to do this?
Let's get the good stuff out there. Let's get the top player.
All right. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone can argue the fact that the greatest number 56 of all time is Lawrence Taylor. I mean, you really think about it, and he truly revolutionized the game of football from that position. I don't think any player on the field today that plays the same position that Lawrence Taylor plays is better than Lawrence Taylor. I mean, the guy was in a positive sense of the word, a freak. I mean, what he did and the way teams had to plan for him is just incredible. And he helped turn around a franchise that was one of the downtrodden franchises of the NFL for so long. And he was really, truly a special player. I wrote down a couple of things about Lawrence Taylor. And I remember watching, I have the NFL Network and I watched the programs on NFL Network. And I remember there was this team meeting with the Patriots and somebody brought up the name Lawrence Taylor to Bill Belichick and, you know, compared that player. I forget what player they were comparing to LT, and Belichick goes, stop. You're talking about LT. Don't even bother. There's no comparison to be made. He was the greatest. End of discussion. Next. And interestingly enough, I saw another thing with Belichick, and somebody brought up J.J. Watt. And Belichick said, you know, maybe you could maybe say something about J.J. Watt, but you're talking about Lawrence Taylor. Just stop.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you just said earlier about him being, you know, there is no argument that he's the greatest 56. I think you can make that same argument. He may be the greatest defensive player ever in the NFL's history.
I think you're on to something, Darren. Like we said, he revolutionized the game. You couldn't stop him. And one of the things I remember hearing was Mark Schlereth, who played for Washington and Denver and a couple of those teams, say he had to play against LT when he was with Washington. He had to play against him twice a year. And he said it was virtually impossible to play against Lawrence Taylor. You couldn't run away from him. You couldn't build your offense to run away from him because he was just too fast and he'd get you. So really the only game plan Washington had for LT was to run the plays at him. And Schlereth said, I knew it was going to hurt, but you know, what else could you do? I knew it was going to be physical. And Washington thought the only way to neutralize Lawrence Taylor was to run at him, keep hitting him and wear him down physically and hope that would slow him down. But as Schlereth said, in the end, that really didn't work out too well either.
Yeah. Just ask Joe Namath how that worked out, huh? Or I'm sorry, Joe Theismann.
That's yeah. I remember watching that game and what a just an absolutely horrible thing. I mean, awful. You know, one of the other guys that used to have to line up against Lawrence Taylor all the time was Ron Jaworski. And I vaguely remember a story, and it might not be 100% completely accurate, but Jaworski is under center. And one of the things he would always do when he was playing the Giants, the first thing he'd look for is, where's LT? And he scopes out the line. He's looking over the line. He's looking for LT. Doesn't see him. Starts barking out the signals. And all of a sudden, LT is there. He winks at Jaworski. Jaworski called timeout. completely threw him off his game. That's the kind of player that LT was. I mean, his stats, I mean, I wrote them down. Some places report he had 142 sacks. I see the most accepted figure, though, is 132 and a half. 1,089 tackles, 56 forced fumbles, 9 interceptions, played in 2 Super Bowls, won both of them, 21 and 25. He was the NFL, not Defensive Player of the Year, not MVP. He was the NFL MVP in 1986. 3 times NFL Defensive Player of the Year, 81, 82, 86. He was the Defensive Player of the Year in 1981. He also won Rookie of the Year that year. 8 times first team All-Pro, 2 times he was a second team All-Pro, 1980s All-Decade team, 75th anniversary team, 100th anniversary team. What else can you say about the guy? And I found this. Here's this website called heavy.com. I'm not very familiar with it, but when I was doing some research for this episode of Pigskin, the Pig Pen, I mean, they had this article called "The Most Dreaded Opponent of All Time," and two guys chimed in. The first guy said, "Fact: Michael Jordan would challenge you both mentally and physically and do everything he could to beat you. Defeating him when he was at the peak of his powers was near impossible." But he wasn't Lawrence Taylor, who struck actual fear into the players he faced. Football is a far more physical game than basketball. While Jordan could embarrass opponents with his sheer athleticism, Taylor could physically dominate opponents and make them concerned for their well-being. He was scary. He was a force of nature. He inspired dread more than any basketball player could. And the other guy said, "I'm going to keep this short. Opponents feared losing when they played Michael Jordan. Opponents worried about their health when they faced Lawrence Taylor. That's a big difference. That will keep you up the night before games and afterwards too."
Yeah, wow, that is definitely something to think about. You know, you can, refer back to Theismann, probably Jaworski too. I'm sure they had some aches and pains, Theismann with the horrendous leg injury, but sure you didn't feel good the next morning. And Shalareth and all the other blockers that had to go up against him, because he was a beast.
And as a Giants fan, I feel fortunate, very fortunate, that I was a Giants fan during LT's career. I got to see him at his greatest. Obviously, unfortunately, he had, and maybe still does, I don't know, so many off the field issues, not criminal issues, but just, you know, he battled with some demons, and he was just a special player. And like you said, he might actually be the greatest defensive player of all time. And if he's not, he's definitely top three or four. No doubt about it.
Yeah, I've heard referring to that 1981 draft that, you know, Taylor was taken number two by the Giants.
Dude, number one was George Rogers.
Right. And that draft, I've heard of maybe the biggest one that if anybody wanted to do over, it'd be New Orleans redoing that draft.
Yeah,
and, knowing what they know now, because he was definitely an impactful player. Not that George Rogers was a bad player, but he wasn't LT. That's for
LT.
Sure.
LT changed. He was a transformative player. He completely changed. He stepped on the field and the Giants were a different team. He made them a contender by himself. He really did. I mean, he was able, you know, you look at some of those NFL films and watching LT play, and, you know, he played, I remember, in a sling and they still couldn't stop him. He was playing with one arm and still just could not be stopped. He was great. Yeah. Absolutely great.
I mean, just think, I think we talked about it when we had jersey number 53, you know, when teams would say, okay, we're going to try to double team block on Taylor. It would open up Harry Carson, you know, and we talked about jersey 53 and helped him out and helped out some of the other Giants teammates. So just the game plan to either, you know, Washington wanting to run at him, and there's probably a lot of teams that did that, and or you know putting a tight end with a help a tackle or whatever they're doing, just changes the whole scheme of that offense and sort of takes them out of the rhythm. Plus, he got through the block, so it still had an impact.
Yeah, it was crazy. Now I do have There is one other good story, and it's about another guy that's in our top 10 with LT.
Okay.
And that's Pat Swilling. So I just happened to catch this the other night. They were doing a show on NFL Network, Bill Parcells. And he tells a story about Pat Swilling in LT. Swilling wore number 56 for the Saints. And for whatever reason, LT had trouble against Irv Pankey, who played left tackle for the Rams. Prior to a game against the Rams, Parcells put a plane ticket on the stool outside of LT's locker. He puts this plane ticket to New Orleans. LT sees the plane ticket and he asks Parcells, "What's this ticket for?" And Parcells told him, "Well, since you don't play well against Irv Pankey, I'm sending you to New Orleans for 1 week to play for the Saints in exchange for Pat Swilling, their number 56, because he's better than you, especially when it comes to Irv Pankey." Well, LT was not exactly happy, and he went on to have one of his best games against the Rams and sacked Jim Everett twice.
That is interesting. Parcells was definitely a motivator. He knew what buttons to push on, you know, each player to get the best out of them.
No doubt.
So yeah, that's a sign of great coaching. Great story.
Yeah. It's a fun story. You got to love watching some of that stuff on NFL Network. They're retrospective pieces on the different players and teams are just so well done and so much fun to watch.
Okay. Yeah. So definitely LT number one. I mean, have a lot of facts there, a lot of great stories, and he's pretty much speaks for himself. Now, I think you had somebody different as your number two. You had
I had Ted Hendricks. You could actually put Chris Dolman number two as well. I they're a flip-flop. And look, Hendricks, I listed Hendricks number two. And I get it. He only wore 56 for 1 year, and that was in 1974 with the Green Bay Packers. He was actually number 83 for the Colts and the Raiders. But with Green Bay, he's just a great player. And the fact that he wore 56 got me to think. And I said, you know what? Yeah, it's a tough call. Is he a great 56? Is he one of the greatest 56? Well, the fact is he was one of the greatest players ever, you know, linebackers. He wore 56. He wore it for just 1 year with the Packers. And in that 1 year, he had five interceptions, a fumble recovery, a safety. He blocked seven kicks, three field goals, three punts, and an extra point. He had 75 tackles, two knockdown passes, two sacks, was an all-pro. I mean, he was a great 56. Even if it was just for 1 year, it showed what he would have done had he wore 56 his whole season. He's an interesting story because the second half of his career with the Raiders was where I knew him best. And he played with the Colts from 1969 through 1973. And he was traded by the Colts to the Packers. And after 1 year with the Packers, he signed a contract because of the money with the Jacksonville Sharks of the World Football League, the WFL. However, the league didn't make it 2 years. It went bankrupt. And Al Davis got his rights by trading two first-round picks to Green Bay. He knew how good Ted Hendricks was, and he wanted him. Well, Hendricks wound up in the Hall of Fame in 1990. He's an eight-time Pro Bowler. He played in seven AFC championship games. He played in four Super Bowls. He won with the Colts, and he won with the Raiders twice. No, he won with the Raiders three times. He won four Super Bowls. He won with the Colts against the Cowboys and won three Super Bowls with the Raiders. I mean, the guy was just, he was great. And that's why I have him as my number two, even though he only wore 56 for 1 year.
I mean, you make a compelling case for him. And maybe you might have changed my mind there. Maybe we'll put him on that list then. So let's go ahead and do that. Let's have so we have LT is on our list. Ted Hendricks is on our list. And I think we're both going to agree probably our next one we talk about is probably Chris Dolman. Yeah. Another great player.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Dolman was just flat out great. He wore 56 his entire career. He played with Minnesota, San Francisco, and Atlanta. He was elected into the Hall of Fame in 2012. The guy was a menace, played defensive end and linebacker, 150 plus sacks, eight interceptions, recovered 24 fumbles. He led the NFL in sacks in 1982 with 21, had a couple of safeties, was an eight-time Pro Bowler, three times he was a first-team All-Pro, two times a second team All-Pro. He was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year in 1992, I think it was. And he was 1990s All-Decade Team. I mean, he helped transform the Vikings into one of the best defensive ball clubs during the 1990s. He was a stud.
Yeah, he definitely was. And, you know, he was probably considered one of those the new purple people eaters. You know, they just had some good defenders on that team, and he sort of had led the class there, and impactful. Again, these outside linebackers, defensive ends. You know, depending on your scheme, he could play both, and he probably fit right in today's game.
Yeah, no doubt. I think he came in the same mold as LT. He played the same style as LT, I think. I mean, he was fast. It was very difficult to run your offense away from him. You sort of had to run it at him. And he was big too. If I remember, he was a pretty big dude.
Yeah, he's listed at coming out of college at 6'5", 289 pounds. That's real big for a defensive end or an outside linebacker, especially.
He wasn't small. He was not small.
Yeah, wow. That's almost offensive lineman size there, you know? That's a big guy.
And he was fast.
Yeah.
He was fast and strong.
All right. Well, that seals up three of our top 10. Now, who did you have as your fourth player on your
list? I actually put in Andre Tippett.
Okay, and I had him third, so good one to talk about next.
Yeah, you know, another guy, a linebacker, played with the New England Patriots throughout the 1980s. I don't think he's as well known he's just not as well known. Doesn't get the recognition that an LT gets, that a Hendricks gets, that a Chris Dolman gets, because he played with a team that frankly just wasn't that good for all those years. Wore 56 his entire career, had 100 sacks even. Excuse me. 19 fumble recoveries, had 2 touchdowns, you know, and again, New England just wasn't that good during his heyday. He played with the Pats from 1982 through 1993. And in that span, they only made the playoffs 3 times. But he was a part of the team that went to the Super Bowl in 1985. Of course, they got stomped on by the Chicago Bears that year. 5 times he was a Pro Bowler, 2 times All-Pro, twice second team All-Pro. He was the Defensive Player of the Year in that 1985 season. He had 16 and a half sacks that year, 4 fumble recoveries. I think he is the all-time sacks leader in New England Patriots history. 1980s All-Decade Team, and he was elected into the Hall of Fame in 2008. He was really good. He was really good. He was great.
Yeah. Can you imagine what would happen if Andre Tippett would have been on a Belichick coached defense? You know, that's it would be lights out. I mean, those 100 sacks are probably, you know, amplified by some unknown number, but they're much greater than 100, I'll bet.
He was wow.
Yeah, he was another good one. Okay, I think he's definitely on our list too. So that takes up 4 spots. Who did you have next on your list?
So this is where it sort of gets a little cloudy for me because I didn't get to see these guys play. So I sort of did my own self-analysis with, you know, evaluating who they played for, what they did, the results of the teams. And my number 5 is Bill Hewitt. And he played for the Bears and the Eagles. He was elected into the Hall of Fame in 1971. He was also an end, a receiver. And he led the NFL in touchdown receptions. And really, that's where I think he probably made the biggest name for himself. So he played a little defensive end, but he was mostly an end. He was mostly a receiver. He led the NFL in touchdown receptions with only 5, and it was in 1934. But, of course, you didn't throw the ball like you do today. He had a career high of 6 in 1936. For his entire career, he had 23 touchdown receptions. He did rush for 1. In 1933, he also threw for 3 touchdowns. He won the 19. He was part of the championship team with the Bears in 1932. And then in 1938, he was part of the championship team with the Eagles. 4 times he was All-Pro first team, twice second team. He was on the 1930s All-Decade Team and the 100th anniversary NFL team. So, you know, if he's good enough to make the NFL 100th anniversary team, he's definitely good enough for my top 10.
Well, I think you changed my mind on him also, because I sort of looked at that. I was sort of gauging, you know, the amount of all pros and Pro Bowls or all-star games that they made. And that's sort of what I was using, especially these players, you know, like Hewitt and, you know, Joe Schmidt that, again, I didn't watch them play either.
Oh, you didn't? I thought you were around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not that old and I don't have a time machine. So no, I was not able to watch them, but yeah, I mean, if he made the NFL's 100, there's a bigger experts than you or I that are studying what he did. And I guess that definitely puts him in a top 10 for a jersey number 56.
And that's exactly why I also have Joe Schmidt up there. He is also a member of the NFL's 100th anniversary team. And, you know, he played with a team that we don't think of as being a very good team anymore. He played with the Lions. And when he was with the Lions, he actually won two NFL championships with the Lions in 1953 and 1956, I think it was. He played with the Lions 53 through 56. Yeah, he was elected into the Hall of Fame in 1973. During the course of his career, he recovered 17 fumbles, including 8. In 1955, he had a career in which he intercepted the ball 24 times. 8 times, he was first-team All-Pro. Twice, he was second-team All-Pro. He played in 10 Pro Bowls. He was 1950s All-Decade Team, 100th Anniversary Team. He was the NFL Defensive MVP in 1960 and 1963. His number 56 is not only retired by the Lions, it's also retired by Pittsburgh, the university, where he played his college ball. And he also coached the Lions. His career record with the Lions is 43 wins with 34 losses and 7 ties. And, you know, the Lions are just, you think of the Lions today, if you're a coach with the Lions and you could finish your career at over 500, that's saying something. He coached them for 6 years. His best year was 1974 when the Lions went 10-4. The last year he was with the team, they went 8-5-1. So I have him as my number 6.
Yeah, I had him at as my 4 spot because I thought he was right up there with the impact of, you know, the maybe not LT, but the, you know, Dolmans and Tippett and probably Hendricks. He was just in his era, just a tremendous player. And like you said, two different teams retired his jersey number. So, yeah, definitely having Joe Schmidt on our list. So that's going to take our 6th position of our top 10. And who did you have next on your list?
Dante Lavelli. Now Dante is interesting because not only did he play in the NFL, he started his career in the AAFC. He played with the Cleveland Browns. His rookie year, he led his league with 40 receptions for 843 yards. Over the course of his career, he had 62 touchdown receptions. His high was in 1947, still in the AAFC, when he had 9. And he also had a career high of 49 receptions that year. He was elected in the Hall of Fame, by the way, in 1975. He helped the Browns to the 1950 NFL Championship. Of course, that's the first year they played in the NFL after those 4 years in the AAFC. He also won the NFL championship with the Browns in 54 and 55. 3 times he was a Pro Bowler. 1940s All-Decade Team. And that's saying something considering he didn't start till 46. And that was really with the AAFC. Won, like I said, 4 AAFC championships, 46, 47, 48, 49. Twice was all pro, you know, all first team AAFC. Twice he was second team AAFC. And the guy was just a champion. Here we said he won 4 times with the Browns in the AAFC, won 3 times with the Browns in the NFL. So that's 7. And he won a national championship with the Buckeyes in 1942, playing for Paul Brown. 8 championships. Pretty good.
Yeah, not too bad at all. I mean, maybe almost like Tom Brady-ish there with the amount of championships.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely a great player. I had him on my list also. And definitely, I think he's going to eat up that seventh spot here on our list. So, okay, now I think things are going to get a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, this is where I think you and I, our paths took different roads here.
Well, I think we have one similar, because I think we could probably agree Pat Swilling's probably the first non-Hall of Famer that should be on that list.
Yeah. Now, he played with New Orleans for 7 years, played with the Raiders for 3 years, and played with the Lions for 3 years. And like I said earlier today, he at least caught the eye of Bill Parcells, you know, with that story about him and Lawrence Taylor. And, you know, yeah, he is not in the Hall of Fame, and he had some pretty good stats. So it's really interesting. He led the NFL in sacks in 1991 with 17. He had 107 and a half career sacks, 6 interceptions, 1 touchdown. He had 11 fumble recoveries. But I think maybe part of the reason – oh, you know what? He was the NFL Defensive Player of the Year in 1991 as well. But I think the fact that he played in New Orleans – and at the time, New Orleans just wasn't the perennial – playoff team they are today. This is just when New Orleans was becoming a playoff type team. He did go with New Orleans, I believe it was. No, twice he went with New Orleans to the playoffs and twice with the Lions. He never won a playoff game. So, you know, I don't know how those who elect players to the Hall of Fame go about it. He was a five times he was in the Pro Bowl, twice he was all pro first team, twice he was all pro second team. So, you know, I think there can be a compelling case that Pat Swilling is one of those guys that have been overlooked for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. You know, he played on that same line, you know, Ricky Jackson, Pat Swilling, and Sam Mills. And I believe, is Jackson the only one that's in the Hall of Fame? I know Mills isn't.
Yeah, he might be.
And that was a fantastic linebacking core. You know, they don't get much better than that. That's
no, and like Dolman and like LT, you had a plan for him. You could not ignore him on the field. He was a pretty devastating player too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think he definitely takes that 8th spot on our top 10, and now's maybe where we start getting a little bit of, you know, deliberating and maybe not seeing eye to eye, and we got to talk each other into for these last two spots. Because
all right, so you go first. You tell me who you have at number 9 or the player that I've skipped.
Well, I'd have to go back and say probably the next player that we didn't both have or that you haven't talked me into yet. I'd say Hardy Nickerson is the next one I would put on there.
And make a case for him, like I said.
Okay.
It won't take much to convince me.
All right. You know, Hardy Nickerson, he spent his first 4 seasons as a Pittsburgh Steeler, and he definitely had an impact there. I'm sorry, he had more than that. He had, he had 6 years with the Steelers, and they were just, sort of searching for the next great linebacker at the time. And he really filled the bill on that. But he did not make a Pro Bowl with the Steelers, which I found kind of surprising. His first year with Tampa Bay was 1993, and he ended up being all pro, and he made the Pro Bowl. And, for his career, he had 21 sacks, which wasn't the biggest part of his game, but 1,272 solo tackles. You know, not combination tackles, solo tackles. That's a big number for anybody. Yeah. The 5 times total is in the Pro Bowl, twice as an All-Pro. The Hall of Fame chose him as the All-1990s team as one of their linebackers. And he wore that 56 for quite a few seasons, too. And that's just some of the evidence I see. So 10 total seasons were in 56. That's the evidence I present. And those tackles really stand out.
Yeah. You know what? You could be convincing me. The guy I had next was Derek Johnson. He played for the Chiefs for 13 years and the Raiders for a year. He finished his career with 27 and a half sacks. He had 14 interceptions and 4 touchdowns. 8 fumble recoveries. He had 1,171 tackles. 4 times he was a Pro Bowler. First team All-Pro in 2011. Second team All-Pro in 2015. And, you know, he played at Texas. And when he was at Texas, he was pretty darn good there, too. He won the Butkus Award. He was the Big 12 Defensive Player of the Year. Twice he was an All-American. 3 times first team All-Big 12. But Hardy Nickerson also won a Super Bowl, right? He won the Super Bowl with the Bucks, and he was part of a great defense there with Sapp. And was that also a Derek Johnson there? No. Derek Brooks. That's it. Derek Brooks. You know, I could see putting Hardy Nickerson in there in the top 10 without a doubt, without a doubt.
I've looked at Johnson real hard, and I got stuck between him and another player that had very similar numbers, Keith Brooking.
I have Brooking next.
And their stats are so similar. I think Johnson had a little bit more sacks, but I believe Brooking had more of the Pro Bowls, if I'm not mistaken.
I have Brooking. He finished his career. He played for 11 years with Atlanta, 3 with Dallas, and 1 with Denver. 13 interceptions and 10 fumble recoveries over the course of his career. Over 1,400 tackles. 5 times he was a Pro Bowler, and he had 22 sacks. So he, too, you know, he's on the fringe there. Who was the other guy that you had, or was that the only difference we had?
Well, no, the other one that I had 2 other that were different. And I took the center, John Morris, because his numbers were tremendous at, you know, as far as Pro Bowls. And I had Al Wilson, but I think you talked me out of Al Wilson. He didn't have the numbers that even Brookings and Johnson had. So I'm willing to drop him up. But John Morris is an interesting one, because
tell me about John Morris.
Well, he was a great center, came in the league in 1964 with the Boston Patriots in the AFC. Of course, turned over to the New England Patriots in the 70s, and then played 3 years with the Detroit Lions and 1 final year in 1978 with the Chicago Bears. But he was a 7-time Pro Bowler, once as an All-Pro. And you know, I can remember this guy. He was an impact at the center position. You never really hear about centers, but you know, I can remember watching in the 70s and people talking about him. And you know, one of the guys that we would watch just watch, you know, his blocking. And I wasn't even a Patriots fan or a Detroit Lions fan, so it's. But I think he had an impactful career, and I just sort of threw a center in there because he was another good player and changed it up from the linebacker core. You know,
I you know what. I'm going to switch my top 10 and include Morris and include Nickerson. You've convinced me. You know, again, offensive linemen, their contributions statistically are so very hard to measure. You know, there's just not a great statistic to measure them by, with the exception of how many times were they all pro or are they in the Hall of Fame? And like I told you, I was Nickerson is a guy who I believe in. Again, the Northeastern connection with my brother. So a little Homer there, but you know what he did? He won a Super Bowl. So I'm going to go Nickerson at 9 and Morris at 10. Goodbye, okay. Derek Johnson, and goodbye, Keith Brooking.
Yeah.
No longer worthy.
I don't know that they're not worthy, but I mean, they're both a tough call, I'll tell you.
I stared at those names. 53, where I think we struggled a little. 56 has got a lot of great players.
And there's a lot of players we didn't even mention, you know, just to substantial players, you know, like Doug Smith and, you know, Len Howes and Robin Cole, Chip Banks, you know, some great players, but they just didn't have those Hall of or All Pro and Pro Bowls and the tackles and the sacks and everything that our top 10 has, you know, just That's a tough number in a different way. You're right. 56 compared to 53.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, it's so many good players wore 56 and are in today's game are wearing 56. And, some of them are being retired, so we won't see 56 like we have previously.
And there was a couple of my Steelers I couldn't even put on there. You know, Ray Mansfield and Lamar Woodley, you know, were great number 56s for the Steelers, but they just didn't even compare to our top 12, top 14 guys even. You know,
yeah, so. I mean, you know, there's some other guys on here too. There's one, just recently left us, you know, not left us that way, left the game, Carlos Dansby. He's done some damage. John Offerdahl. I mean, I remember him. Jeff Lagerman. He was pretty darn good as well. Lance Mell. He was really good with the Jets. There are some, like you said, Chip Banks. There, you know, 56 is a proud number. Let's say it is you got to be good to wear 56. Sean Merriman, another guy that wore 56. I mean, you know, he had a heck of a career with the Chargers. And today, Quentin Nelson with the Colts. I mean, he's really good. You have to plan to play against Quentin Nelson. So there are some really good number 56 out there even today.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, I mean, I think I'm glad we talked about those, you know, another dozen or so players that we didn't even have a great long discussion on, because they were definitely substantial. And that's definitely what this is all about. We want to capture those most substantial players of each jersey number and at least mention them. And we're sorry some of those couldn't make the list, but, you know, any other number, if we're talking 53s, probably half those guys are in the number 53 list.
No doubt.
But 56, that's a difficult number. That's right up there with like 10 and 12. You know, that's
absolutely
a lot of great players.
There are certain numbers where, you know, whoever wore that number, they had to be great to wear that number.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I thank you for helping us choose that. That was a good one, because we had some good discussion and some deliberation there and switching some numbers around. But before I let you go, can you tell us what do you have cooking and coming up on the Sports Forgotten Heroes series?
Sure. I have a show coming up right now on Zach Wheat. He was an outfielder for – at the time when he first got there, they were the Brooklyn Robbies, and I can never pronounce the other name, the Superbas or something like that. Then they finally became the Brooklyn Dodgers, by the way, short for Brooklyn Trolley Dodgers. But Wheat was a great ball player, 300 career hitter, Hall of Famer, over 2,800 career hits. And it's my guest is a guy by the name of Joe Neese, who I've had on a couple of times, including a football podcast about Gus Dore, who was a great football coach. And then right after that, my next podcast is about two ball players who played in the 19 teens, the 1920s, the 1930s. One's a guy by the name of Howard Emke, who an official scorer should have given, and it actually admits he should have given an error to the fielder, but he didn't. And had he given that error to the fielder, Emke would have been the first baseball player, the first pitcher to throw back-to-back no-hitters. He had a wicked arm, and he set the record for most strikeouts in a World Series game in 1929, when he struck out 13 and 12 were swinging. He was a heck of a ball player, and that was for the Philadelphia Athletics. His teammate at the time, one of his teammates at the time, is a guy by the name of Jack Quinn. Jack had an absolutely marvelous career. He pitched If you look at Baseball Reference, they say he was 49. No one ever really knew his name, but my guest, Steve Steinberg, who along with Lyle Spatz wrote a book called Comeback Pitchers, they show that he was actually 51 his final year. And Jack Quinn was a – he was – just this solid human being. He was 6'5" about, just built and was never hurt and believed in staying in shape all year round. He wasn't like the other ball players of the day who, when the season ended, they went home and did whatever. He would be practicing in a mirror, his throwing motion. And he played for the Yankees. He played for the awful, awful Red Sox of the early 1920s. He, too, played for the Philadelphia Athletics. And it's a great story about the two of them, Jack Quinn, Howard Emke. And my guest is the author of a terrific new book, a co-author of a terrific new book by the name of Steve Steinberg, who's been a guest of mine previously. Name of the book is Comeback Pitchers. And I think everybody will really enjoy the story we tell.
Wow. Yeah. Those sound like two great episodes there. Or was there three episodes in that?
It's two episodes.
Two episodes. Okay.
Walkwheat, and one is on Emke and Quinn.
Okay. Okay. It's two players in one episode you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, we just really enjoy, your episodes. And I'm sure all the rest of the listeners have had a chance to go over and check out Sports Forgotten Heroes. Your favorite podcast provider has them on there. Also sportshistorynetwork.com. But the basketball player that got traded for Chamberlain, Archie Clark. Oh, wow. What a great episode that is. And actually have the athlete himself on there telling his story along with an author that wrote a book about him. That was tremendous, Warren. That was really great stuff. And
Bob Kuska's the author. I got Archie on there, and Archie has a terrific story, a really good story. You know, how he brought the shake and bake move to the NBA, the step back to the NBA, traded for Wilt Chamberlain. He was the key player in that trade. Some say the worst trade in the history of the NBA, but the trade was going to be made. And then what he did off the court, fighting for the rights of players to get better contracts, is truly it's really a good story. And then he goes into the details about what crazy travel schedules these guys had, playing 4 days in four cities. You know, could be an afternoon game. In just, you know, the weather that they had to go through and the conditions that they played in, the arenas that they played in. It was a different game when he played. And that, and we're not talking really that long ago. We're talking the late 60s, early 70s. Really good story, and I hope people get a chance to listen to it.
Yeah, and once you do, those forgotten heroes are forgotten no more, because Warren does a great job of bringing us in some remembrance. And maybe, you know, some of them I've never really – heard of before, and you really brought some great recognition to them, and they're forgotten no more. So we thank you for that podcast and preserving this great sports history that we all enjoy.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and once again, Warren, thank you for your time and for coming on. And I think we have you signed up to do jersey number 60. So we'll be talking to you soon on that if you're still a go on that.
All right. Well, we'll talk about it.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Warren.
Take it easy, Darren. Thank you.
Warren, thank you for your time and for coming on. And I think we have you signed up to do jersey number 60. So we'll be talking to you soon on that if you're still a go on that.
All right. Well, we'll talk about it.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Warren.
Take it easy, Darren. Thank you.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.